because the ride we are on in this country right now is going to get rougher, I believe. Rougher, in fact, than any of us can probably imagine sitting here tonight. And we are going to need that hope. I believe we live in a world that is in a deep crisis on every front, political, economic, moral, cultural, and perhaps most crucially and most dangerously, ecological. Now, this is not the first time the world has faced such crises, but I do believe it is the first time that we have confronted such global crises on so many fronts with so little time for correcting the course. I think our margin of error is shrinking by the day, and while I cannot give you any definitive logic or data to prove this point, I think we are facing threats of a new and quite frightening order. I think the widening of the inequality gap, both internally in the U.S. and worldwide, the pace of technological change and the accompanying unintended consequences of that change, and the destructive capacity not only of the military machine in this country, but of the way we live our daily lives, all have upped the ante in ways we cannot really understand. I think the fallout of our failures can no longer be easily contained and will not remain localized as it has in the past. I believe we are stumbling into something that I don't think we really quite understand. But if you look at the markers of the intensity of these threats, the breakdown of the values needed to sustain real human community, and the weakening of the ecological fabric, I think we can see the nature of that threat if we so choose to see it. So what I'm suggesting is, as bad as you might think it is today in the United States, it's probably going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And I think, more importantly, a lot of folks, even folks who don't want to think about that, feel it at some level in a kind of visceral way. I think a lot of people sense we are on the edge of something that is at best going to be incredibly destabilizing and destructive, and at worst is potentially catastrophic. In fact, I think some of the cultural fascination with the rapture and the book of Revelations is probably rooted in a quite sane recognition of this fact. That is, it may not be crazy to talk about the end time at this point. But I do think it is crazy not to try to name and to understand and to fight against the forces that are propelling us toward that end time. Now, personally, I assume there are people of different theological backgrounds here. I don't call those forces Satan. I call them nationalism and patriotism, capitalism, affluence and greed, white supremacy, patriarchy, and the reflexive glorification of high technology that we live with in this culture. The problem, I don't think, is some abstract notion of evil, nor, and this is important, nor is the problem the devious actions of a few people here on Earth. I think the problem is in the nature of the systems and institutions with which we live. And I think the painful reality is that decent people in this country will abandon their own stated values and therefore abandon part of their own humanity when operating in those systems. And I don't say that from high up. I think we know this because all of us at some point in our life have done it. We have all twisted ourselves to fit into these institutions and systems. But understanding the nature of that struggle in this way gives us an advantage, because if we can name the systems and institutions that we must resist, and not only resist but change and I think eventually destroy, then we can begin the hard work of creating the path that can lead us toward that change. But I think we have to recognize that to do that places upon us quite a burden. Because while hope is for the weak, it is not for the passive. While real hope requires a humility and a sense of our own limits, it does not and should not lead us to some sort of paralysis based on those limits. At this moment in history, I think, especially for those of us who live in the U.S. empire, if we say we are hopeful without engaging in a much deeper analysis and action, then we are, in fact, engaging in another form of laziness and cowardice. If we want to claim hope, we also have to take on the burden of hope, which is responsibility for our part in changing the direction in which this world in crisis is heading. To say that one is holding on to hope, but then to turn away from that obligation, is in fact less admirable than the cynics. At least the cynics have abandoned any pretense of their interest in the collective effort. We need to be accountable in that way. Now, I want to highlight here that what I'm saying is that if we have this hope, it should lead not only to action, but to a much deeper analysis, which brings me to the second part of this title, the challenge of a broken world. There's a lot of pain in this world and a lot of suffering. And in a world like that, some people, of course, will always turn away, but some people will also rush to action, and in fact, any action. When there is this much pain around us, and in fact, this much pain in us, how can one not feel that compulsion to act, to do something, anything that will relieve whatever suffering can be relieved in people's lives, and therefore help us relieve some of our own pain? And in fact, I think we should nurture that instinct, because that is what makes us human. But I also think at this moment in history, it is crucial not simply to rush to action, but to take some time to deepen our analysis. And that assumes that I'm suggesting that the existing liberal, progressive left movements in the United States have offered us a rather shallow analysis. And in fact, that is what I do believe. And I think the shallowness of our analysis poses a serious threat to our ability to translate hope into real change. Now, that might sound arrogant, and I want to make it clear. It's a statement born more out of desperation than any arrogance. I don't claim to have the analysis to offer, but I do believe we're in a period in which traditional liberal, progressive, and left analyses are inadequate to understand the world and therefore inadequate bases for us to go forward. I can't tell you standing here tonight that I know we can win or what strategy is necessary to win. I'm not even sure that winning is possible, but I do think it is time to engage in the conversation that can perhaps shift us onto a winning path. And perhaps, if nothing else, we can act in ways that will suggest we deserve to win. The first, and I think perhaps the most important move in this, is to recognize that long ago, we humans outstripped our ability to fully understand and control the consequences of our actions. The crises we find ourselves in today are largely the product of social systems and technological advances that I believe have moved far past our point of control. To quote from Wes Jackson, who's a researcher in sustainable agriculture and a social philosopher of sorts, we've fallen prey to our belief that human knowledge is adequate to run the world. Let me say that again. I think that's an important thought of Wes's. We have fallen prey to the belief that human knowledge is adequate to run the world. That is a dangerous thing to believe, especially in this complex world of nation states and stateless armed forces, this world in which the forces of nature have been distorted by our meddling in creation and our meddling in ways we have never really fully understood. So I'm proposing step one. Let us recognize our ignorance. Recognize that as a species, we are extraordinarily clever, but generally not terribly wise, and that our intelligence is not deep enough to pull off this attempt to control the world. Step two is to recognize the paradox that we land in, which Wes Jackson also talks quite a bit about. If we have to give up the illusion that our knowledge is adequate to run the world in any sustainable fashion, at the same time we have to realize the consequences of our tampering already in that world, the way we have mucked things up, requires that we cannot give up on knowledge completely. The consequences of our hubris require that we continue to seek knowledge in order to reverse the course of destruction. And this is, in fact, a very tricky proposition. If we're going to pull this off, if we're going to pursue the knowledge we need, yet rein it in with humility, we have to believe that we can, in fact, use knowledge differently. All the time we're aware of our propensity of failure. And I think it's important to recognize that this is a tall order. It requires a hope that balances humility and harshness. We have to be kind to ourselves and to one another and yet brutally honest at the same time. And in fact, perhaps we need to go beyond harshness to become quite ruthless in our hope. Here I always like to quote from one of the Western world's most well-known philosophers, who in a letter at the age of 25, as a very young man, said this: "There can be no doubt about the task confronting us at the present. The ruthless criticism of the existing order, ruthless in that it will shrink neither from its own discoveries nor from conflict with the powers that be." Now, that was a statement by Karl Marx. And of course, it's not unusual for radicals to exhort us all to confront power. But the more interesting part of that statement to me is Marx's claim that we must not shrink from our own discoveries. And this is the need for a deeper analysis that I'm trying to talk about, the need to shake off dogma, to refuse to hide in the assumptions that have provided some minimal comfort in this broken world. I think there is a need to be ruthlessly honest about the systems and the institutions in which we live. And I think if we are to have hope, honestly, there is no other choice. So what are these discoveries from which we should not shrink? I think the most important ones cluster around my earlier point about the nature of the systems and the institutions in which we live, because it is always tempting, especially after a few years of the Bush administration, it is always tempting to want to blame individuals. There's no shortage of individuals to blame on the scene today. But I think that would be a fatal error. In other words, what I'm saying is the problem is not George W. Bush and the gang of thugs who gave us the Afghanistan and Iraq debacles. The problem is, in fact, the brutality of empire. The problem is not simply Ken Lay and the bad boys of Enron, but in fact, inhuman nature of corporate capitalism. The problem is not simply that there is sex and violence on television, but the reality that the television is on, always on, in so many homes. The problem is not simply the overt racism of the Ku Klux Klan, but the polite ways in which we nice white liberal folks can so easily avoid the realities of white supremacy, which is so deeply woven into the fabric of this world. The problem is not simply the men who rape, but the men who let them rape without consequence. And the problem, finally, is not simply the greed and stupidity of Donald Trump, but the greed and stupidity of us all. What I'm suggesting is that being lovingly ruthless is not easy. For the past decade, I have been slowly trying to come to terms with my own discoveries, and this is hard. This is hard because these are discoveries both of the extent to which this world is broken, why it is broken, and the degree to which it has broken us inside. I think in those years I have been trying to confront this, I have discovered, as have many of us, I suspect most of us in this room, that this is a world in which, from the level of the global to the most personal, there is virtually no one who is really safe in this world. It is a world in which powerful nations unleash a grotesque yet highly sanitized violence that is supposedly in the benefit of those whose worlds we are in fact destroying. It is a world in which men invade the most intimate spaces of women and then demand women's silence about that violence. It's a world in which the affluent step over homeless people on their way to the mall. It is a world in which white people continue, 40 years after the civil rights movement's achievements, to demand that non-white people bear the burden of our own inability to confront the pathology of whiteness. And to me, most frightening of all, it is a world in which we are drawing down the ecological capital of this planet in a way that is no longer sustainable, not in the long term, not even now in the short term. That is, what I'm suggesting is we have a simple discovery we must confront ruthlessly. We were given a place in creation, a beauty beyond the telling, and we have failed to care for it. And as our contempt for the non-human world has intensified, I think so has our contempt for each other. And we have failed to care for each other as well. And those are our failures, and we are individually responsible for them. But I think it's important not to see those failures as simply those of individuals, but as failures of the systems in which we live. And that means that the solution is not simply to make ourselves individually better people. We could transform ourselves individually into saints, but as long as those systems and those institutions endure, the inevitable failures that are part of their nature will continue. Capitalism produces inequality. Nation states go to war. And the high energy, high technology society in which we live destroys the basis for sustained life. And as hard as it is for us individually to become a better person, it would be comforting to think that personal transformation would take us all the way home. But it isn't, and it never will be enough. It's hard enough for us to confront ourselves and to change, but it is immeasurably more difficult to become part of the struggle to change that which is outside of us. And yet, my argument is that is exactly what hope demands of us in this broken world. But again, that is not, in a sense, the most difficult thing that hope demands, because the hardest discovery from which we must not shrink is related to that first point I made about the limits of human knowledge. As we intensify our commitment to analyze and to act, we have to abandon any certainty about that analysis and action. We have to cope with a fundamental uncertainty that is going to dog us as we take our own place in that struggle. And that is the hardest of all. Because I think the claim to know for sure, which is so enticing, the claim to know, is in fact to mark yourself as a coward. I think those who claim to know actually have looked into the face of the crisis and refused to acknowledge it, to say, I cannot bear that crisis. and people then retreat to certainty. I see conservative Christians do this. I see agnostic sectarian leftists do this. I see my academic colleagues do this in spades. I see some of my political allies do it, and every day I battle to not do it myself. I think these are radically uncertain times in which no one has the answer. In fact, I don't think there is the answer. I think there is a deepening crisis that we first must struggle to understand before we begin to even imagine the answers. And again, to quote from Wes Jackson, as he puts it, the task today might be to pose questions that go beyond the available answers. So what I'm suggesting is we have to hold on to our uncertainty and our convictions all at the same time, and that is, in fact, hard. The question is, can we identify values on which we will not budge and will not surrender, and at the same time understand that the path to living those values may be unclear at any given moment? I don't think we have a choice in this. I think we cannot honestly claim hope if we cannot face that. And if we cannot face that, I believe creation is probably lost to us forever. I'm going to quote here from a poem, or read a poem, by Wendell Berry, who some of you may know as a sort of touchstone in the movement to create a sustainable world. He talks about the real work and wrote, in fact, a poem called The Real Work, and it's short. I'll read it. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work, and that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Now, standing up here, I don't pretend to know where we're heading if we follow the singing stream. I'd have no idea, in some sense, where this journey will lead us. But to quote a fairly new friend of mine, although an old new friend, a radical activist, 90-year-old radical activist named Abe Osheroff, none of you would know. In a long interview I did with Abe this summer, he said, "There's no destination for the train I'm on." He said, "No destination, just a direction." Now that's easy for Abe to say, because Abe is 90 and the son bitch is going to die pretty soon, and he knows it. And quite frankly, I find the lack of a destination somewhat more troubling. So here what I'm going to do is really what preachers do, which is quote the Bible, mumble a bit, and hope that people don't realize I don't have a clue about any of this stuff. So, brothers and sisters, let us turn for our text for today. I have been in Texas long enough to know how to play Baptist. Psalm 42, number 5, which says, "Hope is God." Okay, so I went for something simple when I went to the Bible, but you know, I'm not a theologian, so cut me a little slack here. Hope in God. And for the sake of discussion here, I don't really care what any individual's theological background is. Just for the sake of discussion, let's say we buy that we should hope in God. I think whatever one's own personal theology is, it's important to acknowledge that in the end, God is mystery. And if that's true, then the command really is hope in mystery. And in that case, if our lot in life is to place our hope in mystery, well, then our ignorance may not need to frighten us quite so much. Because then our hope can root itself less in what we claim to know and more in that which is beyond our knowing. In other words, we can get on that train without knowing the destination. And as long as I'm going to the Bible here, let me try one more out on you. This from the New Testament. As I said, I think it's important to realize that things are going to get worse in this country before they get better. And because they're going to get worse in this country, I think they're going to get a lot worse in the world. And the path I'm talking about, and I think the path many of us are trying to get on, is not going to be a popular path. It's not a terribly popular path right now, and it's not going to be any more popular in the coming years. When you confront systems and institutions, it does not win you promotions and salary increases at work. And more importantly, it does not lead to the easy company of friends. Instead, as the culture's fear deepens, such honest talk tends to mark one as a threat, as someone to be marginalized, as someone to be ignored and laughed at. So how do we deal with that? Well, if one wants to look in the language of the gospel, what I'm talking about is the decision to choose the narrow gate. This comes out of Matthew chapter 7, verses 12 through 14, when Christ says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter it are many. But the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. And I don't want to, you know, appear melodramatic up here, but in my gut, when I'm alone with myself, I think this is in fact the task and this burden of hope, that we have a struggle now that really is a question of, will that take us toward destruction or toward life? And that is a hard thing to face, and I think it is going to get harder. But I think what can save us is to remember that on that path, whatever that train is we step on with Abe, whatever that journey might be, that we are not alone in that struggle. And here, rather than the Bible, I want to go to a secular version of much the same concept. It's from a song called Bread and Circuses. It's a painfully beautiful song by Billy Bragg and Natalie Merchant that's about the hypocrisy of much of contemporary religion. And in that song, they write, "The gates of hell stand open wide, but the path of glory you walk single file." And if we walk through the gates of hell, which open widely for us in this culture, of course, we will never want for company. Many are passing through it as we speak. But if we do choose that narrow gate, we do have to face the fact there is a moment when we will walk through that gate alone. But I think the importance of that song of Bragg and Merchant is that we really never walk through it truly alone. When you walk single file, you are not alone. When you walk single file, it means there is someone in front of you, someone who can reach back if you stumble with a hand. And it also means that there will be somebody behind you coming up who will need your hand as well. So to be weak and yet hold on to hope, in other words, to be human in the deepest sense, which means neither turning from the pain of this world, which is so broken, nor turning away from the joy that creation has always offered us, is to remember the beauty of those two simple acts, a hand extended out of our own need for love and the help of others, and a hand offered to others out of that same love. Now, personally, I don't think we will ever fully understand that love. Like God, I think that that is mystery, and all we can do is trust in it. But I think we also always have to remind ourselves that in action, that is a harsh and dreadful love. So part of our work today and every day, I think, is to pursue politics in the moment. We have to agitate for the policies that we believe to be just, to try and effect small changes to make the world a better place, to make those reforms that, while limited, can make a very big difference in the lives of individual people. And that kind of work goes on. That political work, which is our work in the world, is always in front of us. But I also think we need to understand that in a world that is as broken as the world in which we live, those kinds of reforms always must come forth from a radical analysis, that is, an analysis that does go to the root of the problem. And while we can work to make this a kinder world in the moment, we have to keep our minds on that ruthless task of preparing for the future, for the moment in which the terrain on which we work, I think, may shift very quickly. I think in that world we will face choices that we cannot now predict. I think we will need a strength that we do not now have. I think we will be forced to know and trust each other in ways that we do not really know and trust ourselves yet. And the only place that trust will come from is community, and that is the community that is built through organizations like the Peace and Justice Center, community built through organizations like KPFT, communities built by all of the groups that come together out of a sense of justice. Now, I think this kind of radical work has never been more important because I think this moment of change is coming. I think the moment when that path of glory will open up to us is coming sooner than we probably know. And that, in a sense, is the hopeful news. But in that hope, I think we also have to face a very ruthless truth about the moment in which we live, which is we are not yet ready for that moment. As a community, we are not strong enough, and the question in front of us right now is, will we be ready in time? And that is the question, will we be ready in time when that moment, that path of glory opens up? That is the question that haunts me. It is the question I think should haunt all of us, and I think it is the question that hope demands that we face. Thank you.
You have been listening to Robert Jensen delivering a talk called Hope is for the Weak, at the Houston Peace and Justice Center Awards Dinner in Houston, Texas, on November 11th of 2005. Robert Jensen is a journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin and a member of the board of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center. He is the author of The Heart of Whiteness, Race, Racism, and White Privilege, and Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, both from City Lights Books. He can be reached at rjensen, that's J-E-N-S-E-N, at uts.cc.utexas.edu.
Thanks to the LA Sound Posse for that recording. Check them out at lasoundposse.org. In a recent article in his political journal Situations, Stanley Aronowitz put forward a plan to create an organized radical movement not based on contending within the political hierarchy, but outside it. Aronowitz is professor of sociology and urban education at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He's the author of numerous books on class, culture, the sociology of science, and politics, and was a union organizer before becoming an academic. Last week, during the transit workers' strike, he was interviewed by Bill DeFazio and Dina Colbert on WBAI in New York City about his proposal. Interviewer Bill DeFazio asked the first question.
I'm very upset with the left. I want to make a statement before I even ask the question. I've been very upset with the left, and one of the reasons is, you can see during the TWU strike, is not that the left isn't supportive of TWU, but they're supportive and almost invisible, including myself. And with that, that upset makes me think that the left is increasingly irrelevant in the United States. And what I want to ask Stanley is, how can the left become relevant again and become a political force in at least the United States, Stanley?
Well, as you said, in the next issue of Situations and in a forthcoming book, which I hope will be out sometime late in the spring, I have argued that we need a party, and that party should not be confused with either the Democratic Party or the Green Party or the various communist or socialist parties of the past. We need a party which is a radical party that has a vision for a new society and that has a series of interventions in our current society which make it both visible and make it alternative to the dominant liberal and conservative debate, which is going absolutely nowhere in our country. That party, in the first place, would have a newspaper. Ideally, at some point, it would be a daily newspaper, but at least initially, it ought to be a weekly newspaper. It would have members who, when the transit workers go on strike, or even running up to that strike, it would be distributing leaflets in front of subway stations and bus places, urging riders to support the transit workers. It would be a force in the city and, by extension, around the country to really support a militant labor, militant anti-war, militant ecological and feminist and black freedoms and Latino and Asian freedom struggles in a way that is not being done today. You see, the union, the Transit Workers Union, has just gotten around to having one of its members of the executive board, Eladio Diaz, write a leaflet. It's a good leaflet, but it's a short leaflet, and it's written on the second day of the strike. Now, Eladio has been one of the people in the Transit Workers Union. He's a member of their executive board who's made an argument that the union has to have larger outreach beyond its own membership and the labor movement. And the problem is, the unions do not see this as their perspective. Now, somebody's got to fight inside the union movement for that perspective to take hold. When Juan Gonzalez, who is a columnist for the Daily News, spoke today, he really represented that kind of outreach that the labor movement desperately needs. I don't think it could be done by individuals. I don't think it's a Bill DeFazio or a Stanley Aronowitz or a Juan Gonzalez that can do it alone. What we need is a political force that actually intervenes in these situations to do the kinds of jobs that the unions at this point can't do, that even the anti-war movement can't do, which is to have a regular ongoing conversation about how to change our society and how to defend what we already have. One of the problems is that we don't have a force in this city and the country that unifies cultural efforts, that unifies people. We had a conference of the center that I'm the director of at CUNY Graduate School on music. We had about 100 people there. We could multiply that. We can't depend on the Daily News weekend calendar or, for that matter, the Village Voice. We have to have our own outreach and press to say to people, look, we're doing stuff that's really important. Maybe you want to come to LaGuardia Community College. Maybe you want to come to the Graduate Center. Maybe you want to come to a union hall where something is going on. But they have to know about it. And if they get to know that there is this newspaper, this outreach, this telephone number, this website that is one that represents a political force, we might begin to build audiences and build participation in cultural activities, not just poetry and music, but obviously theater and many other things that are missing in our city for people on the left especially. And the third thing that we need to talk about, and it's very serious, we have to discover to what degree do we want to participate in electoral activity. Now, I know, Bill, because you and I have been friends for umpteen years, you're not the greatest fan of electoral activity, and by the way, neither am I, even though I ran for governor on the Green Party ticket. Electoral activity is a second or third line of defense, but we can't give up the election route to express our points of view. Gloria Matera, a Green Party candidate, ran for borough president in Brooklyn, got about 7% of the vote, and there have been several council candidates who have been running as independents. I am not a person who believes that you have to disdain the Democratic primary. That may be a very interesting event in 2006 when either Jonathan Tessini and or Steve Greenfield run against Hillary Clinton for senator. But this is not the focus of a party that really thinks about fundamental change. The main focus has got to be to stimulate activities inside of unions, stimulate activities inside of social movements, in communities, to begin to take some leadership in the fight against people removal, which is called redevelopment, to fight about the issues, for example, of rent control and rent stabilization. We have a $2,000 cap, which is absolutely absurd in the city of New York, to fight for the removal of the cap and fight on tenants' issues. And this, by the way, is just part of what we need to be doing. Among other things, I would like to suggest some visionary things. The Argentine workers, when they shut down, when employers shut down a number of plants in Buenos Aires and everywhere, Argentine workers did not simply leave the plants empty. They moved in and occupied the plants, not as the American workers did in the 30s to get recognition for their union so they could engage in collective bargaining, but they moved into the plants and started producing things on a cooperative nonprofit basis. They're challenging the profit system. They're challenging the concept of private property, which is terribly important to do because this is the basis of neoliberalism, that property is king or queen or whatever. And they began to take very, very direct action in that occupation. Of course, the courts hated it. The government tried to remove them. They fought for their position. And they still have, in Brazil and Argentina, literally dozens of plants that have been occupied by workers and are functioning as producers' co-ops.
Okay. So, Stanley, with that in mind, let me just ask you the underbelly question. Does capitalism work? And if not, can you give examples and explain why it doesn't?
Well, I mean, Dina, you just hit the nail right on the head. Capitalism no longer works in behalf of the people. We learned that in Hurricane Katrina. By the way, in that situations issue that I mentioned, which is issue number 2, January, Bill DeFazio has a very short and punchy article about Hurricane Katrina and how capitalism has literally failed in Hurricane Katrina. As he has argued elsewhere, it's failed the poor. Capitalism does not work. It's not meeting the needs of the people. But there's nobody out there right now in a coherent, unified way who is saying capitalism doesn't work. We need a new way of thinking about stuff. Public services, public goods have been given a lousy name. And people, and we, I say we, I mean collectively, have let the public sector and public, the concept of public goods and public services fester and in many cases die. Now, to give you some examples, one of the things that happened historically is that, and it still exists, it doesn't exist much anymore in New York, and it doesn't exist much in the country, is that people organized consumer co-ops, and they were organized primarily by the socialists. The socialists had supermarkets and individual grocery stores that were organized on a cooperative basis. We have one very large 10,000-member co-op in New York City. We have several, one on the Lower East Side, which is called East Village now, which is relatively small. But the big one is in Park Slope. And there are 10,000 members in that co-op, and they get high-quality food. It's nonprofit. It competes very successfully with the commercial stores in the neighborhood, which can't basically match the quality of food that they have, and it's based partly on sweat labor, which means that people put in a couple of hours a week in return for which they can continue to be members of the co-op and get the benefits of the co-op. But we should have co-ops organized all over the country on this basis. Now, the second example I would give is that when in the 70s we began to see deindustrialization in all over the country, some unions and some communities banded together and organized what were called ESOPs, economic opportunity co-op organizations. And what they did is take over the plant from a company that was moving and sometimes paid a considerable amount of money, but they took over the plant and began to run them cooperatively. Well, they didn't run them cooperatively, actually. They let a new management come in, and they had union members and community people sit on the board of directors. The mistake that they made, one of the mistakes that they made, is that they didn't really have control over the labor process or over the business of the company. And in some cases, these just became regular companies. And I can give an example of that, which is United Airlines, where the workers allegedly took over the airline when it was in deep trouble, but let professional management continue to run the airline and had very little voice in the running of the airline and setting the wages and setting the benefits and its operation generally. Well, those are just two examples. These cooperative ownership of industry still exists in the United States. It is not getting any kind of publicity. It's not been really duplicated. Consumer co-ops have been really declining. We used to have farmer co-ops. Many of those have declined, except there are still some very strong ones around in the Midwest and even in the Northeast. But where do we find the force that will be able to push these kinds of ideas and policies forward? That's really important. And we don't have it. And let's take the final example to answer to your question. At one time, we had a welfare rights movement in this country, which was, especially in this city, which was a movement of the poor. And that welfare rights movement, you know, fought for better benefits, and they fought for better clothing and so on. They came up in the late 60s with a proposal for guaranteed income. And when Daniel Patrick Moynihan actually implemented that proposal, when he was Nixon's domestic policy advisor, they turned it down because it was too small. That is, it was not enough. It was $1,600 per capita. But the point is that they were a force that was advocating and acting on, through demonstration, through activity, very, very serious structural reforms in the ways in which this country did its business, especially in dealing with the working poor and the unemployed poor.
Michael Harrington always said that we could never be more, we progressive socialists, etc., could never be more than the significant left wing of the Democratic Party.
That's what he said. He called
the left wing of the possible. Right. We're talking together. Let's do it. Coral speaking. The left wing of the possible. I'm satisfied with that, Stanley, aren't you?
Michael Harrington followed a line of his mentor, a guy named Max Shackman. What they thought they would do was they were going to realign the Democratic Party, throw out the conservatives, and have a genuine liberal progressive party in the United States that was pro-labor and pro-environment and all kinds of things. and it turned out that they had some moment of success. That moment was 1968 to 72, when they nominated George McGovern as their candidate for president of the United States. What happened at that time is the AFL-CIO walked out on the Democratic Party and did not support McGovern. McGovern got beat so badly that it was never tried again. That is, that you never had a progressive candidate after that. You had a Jimmy Carter, you had a Bill Clinton. You might call Walter Mondale a sort of an old-time New Dealer, but he was certainly not a progressive. I think that strategy has failed. And I think the reason the strategy has failed is because the Democratic Party cannot be reformed. It is a second party of big business. This is an old analysis, which people used to make fun of, especially Harrington, because they had, you know, individuals like Bobby Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy and George McGovern to point to. But the fact of the matter is that if you look around the Congress, for example, you will discover in the Senate that there's one or two or three genuine dissenters. Forget about radicals. And one of them is Russell Feingold. He is the senator from Wisconsin, the only senator in 2001 who voted against the Patriot Act, the only senator. And now the Democrats are trying to amend the Patriot Act, but nobody dare, with the exception of Feingold, say, repeal the Patriot Act. That's a radical gesture. And we don't have anybody in the Democratic Party, in either House, prepared to say such things. Oh, yeah, there is John Conyers and I guess Bernie Sanders and one or two others. But essentially, there's no block of a left block in Congress. That would be a good thing to try to get. But you're not going to get it inside the Democratic Party, which is not to say that if there are possible individual campaigns, they should not be supported. What we need, if we're going to have any kind of electoral chance at all, is a party outside the Democratic Party that's prepared to challenge it as well as challenge the Republicans. Now, one of the issues, Bill, that always trumps what my suggestion is that the electoral system is rigged. It's rigged not only by gerrymandering districts so that people who have no common interests can actually be a member of the same congressional district, but it's gerrymandered because a small party, that is a party, say, that got 5% of the vote, cannot have representation in Congress and state legislatures in most of the city councils around this country. Well, we have to make a fight for electoral reform. It's not the main fight, but it is a fight that's necessary to make. We have to say proportional representation and instant runoff voting are two ways that you can have representatives of minor parties. Now, look at the 2000 election. Ralph Nader got 3.7 million votes. He failed to get the 5% that would have qualified him for campaign financing for the next election. But if there had been proportional representation, some way in which congressional and national representation could be addressed with a minor party, I bet he could have gotten 7 or 8 million votes. I actually think that the left, progressive to the left, has about 10% of the vote in the United States, maybe 8% of the vote. But you can't have that registered in electoral sense unless you have electoral reform. Short of electoral reform, I'm pretty much for not having an electoral emphasis in any development of a new party. I want to focus on the unions. I want to focus on the communities. I want to focus on issues of civil liberties, the Black Freedom Movement, the feminist movement, the environmental movement, and movements of immigrants. I think and the poor. I think that's the real focus, and some of it will get into the electoral arena, but most of it won't. Now, Michael Harrington had no conception of social movement at all, except the unions. That's all he cared about, and he was ready to play games with the top union leaders. He loved Walter Reuther of the UAW, for example, and he loved any liberal socialist union leader, William Whippensinger of the Machinists and so on. But he would never say, look, we got to go down deep to the bottom of the society. We got to go down deep to the communities of our society. That's what a new party has to do.
So, Stanley, let me turn to another aspect of what you've been discussing. In what ways can an intellectual voice contribute to a workers' movement in order for the masses to be able to defend themselves And would that set up a tiered internal system rather than a unifying force?
Well, intellectuals, relatively few of us, I'm both a union activist and an intellectual, and I'm proud of being an intellectual, have been contributing to the transit workers' struggle by going on the radio, by writing about it, by being able to talk to people in the newspapers. Yesterday I talked to Bill Murphy of Newsday. I've also talked to people in the New York Times. What you do as an intellectual is that you use your position as an alleged expert to take a very strong position in behalf of the union. That is one way in which we've contributed. The second way is that this may be a surprise to many of your listeners, but the fastest growing, I'll say it again, the fastest growing part of the labor movement is in higher education. That is an incontrovertible fact. You can talk about justice for janitors, they're very good, but higher education has added more members to the labor movement in the last decade than any other sector of American society. So we're getting graduate students, we're getting professors, we're getting, you know, maintenance workers as well as clerical workers in higher education into unions, and that means that they're not simply intellectuals of the old type, which are people who sort of are distanced from unions but support them and are sympathetic. We're getting people who are union members and even union leaders. Now, the second part of your question is a very important problem, and it's always a problem, that intellectuals, partly because of their you know, their skill and partly because of their training, tend to take over. And that fight has to be made on a day-to-day basis in a new political formation. We have to prevent the intellectuals from taking over. And people who are working people and people who are, you know, people without credentials and without qualifications of that kind have to be essentially in control of the organization. The intellectuals have a role. They are people who can teach in political schools. And when I was a member of the New American Movement, I did a lot of teaching in Los Angeles when I lived there, in that area. We also did a lot of educational work around the country. Intellectuals as journalists can write newspapers and can produce journals like Situations, our journal, and they can do a lot of very interesting things, you know, but they cannot control a political formation. The success of any political formation will be the degree to which activists and rank-and-file people, both in unions and in neighborhoods and in and social movements, are really the heart and soul of that movement. And bureaucratism and intellectual elitism is one of the great dangers. On the other hand, without intellect, without ideas, without vision, without people who can write, can speak, such a movement will die a boring. We can't be boring people. We have to be people who are really out there and very interested. I just want to point out that Roger Toussaint, the president of the Transport Workers Union Local 100, is an intellectual. This is a person who is educated. He speaks eloquently. He is not simply somebody who talks slogans. He has an analysis, and many of the members of that union are people who are rank-and-file track workers or conductors, read books, think, put out the New Directions Caucus, which put Roger into office in 2000, put out a very, very good newspaper, and many of those people are people who read a lot. And you know how I know that? Because they read me.
Stanley, You write a lot about in this wonderful article that's going to be in Situations in January, in the January issue of Situations, I guess. You write a lot about the importance of a radical press. Could you tell us why it's important and how would we?
Well, I mean,
how would we raise the money to have a radical press?
I think that's a very good question. The first place I'll talk about the importance. I've had some experience with a radical press. I was a columnist for The Guardian between 1968 and 70, and I wrote a column every week. And that column was read by about 35,000 plus, you know, other people. They said their audience was about 100,000 people. During the period of the late 1960s, The Guardian was the newspaper, it was a news weekly, that brought together people who were involved in the anti-war movement, and many who were involved in the union movement, many who were involved in other feminists and other social movements, the Black Freedom Movement as well, of course. And how do I know this? I mean, it's because I got letters, because I got telephone calls, because I got newspaper got letters, because I got invited to speak all over the country, largely because people were reading my column. Now, that's just one thing. Now, historically, let's put it this way, the socialist and communist press between 1900 and about 1955, but 50 is more like it, and the left liberal press in New York City, PM, The Compass, and The Star, were read by literally tens of thousands of people. The Appeal to Reason, for example, which was came out of Girard, Kansas, had 700,000 readers for a news weekly like The Guardian. In other words, The Guardian was pretty small, 35,000-40,000, but they had 700,000. The party that they were connected to, the Socialist Party, literally supported the Appeal to Reason. And the communists had a daily newspaper in the 1920s through the 1950s, maybe the mid-50s, the Daily Worker. And the Daily Worker was not simply a newspaper that did political reporting from the communist point of view. They had one of the best sports sections in the city. Lester Rodney was, at that time, their sports writer. He was one of the major forces that helped to desegregate Major League Baseball. He is now widely accredited with having brought in Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers and Monty Irvin to the New York Giants. These papers, with all of their faults, and they did have a lot of faults, including The Guardian, were places where you were able to mobilize people, not just around issues, but around a set of campaigns and ideas. And without such a force, that is, one now that would have to be on the internet as well as in hard copy in newspaper, you don't have the possibility of bringing together. I use the term in my article that the party mediates between movements and history, and that's what the newspaper's key function is: to give movements a sense that they're part of a much larger struggle, which has genuine historical significance. And I think if you don't have that, then people still fight against the war in Iraq or for some benefit here or there or for national health insurance, all of which are very important fights, but they do have historical significance, and they have the significance in the general struggle against capitalism. We haven't had a struggle, we haven't had a vital mass paper press that has been able to fight capitalism and show how capitalism doesn't work, I think, in 50 years, 45 years anyway.
So let me change topics for a little bit here. What structure do you envision for a full participatory democracy?
What? I'm sorry?
What structure?
Structure. For a full participatory democracy? Well, mm-hmm. In the first place, you can't have a full participatory democracy if you have a central government that rules 300 million people or 1.5 billion people, or like in China, or 1.1 billion people like in India. You have to have a lot of a very local, community-based, regional-based, both economies and democratic political structures. One of the things that I said before is that you can't have genuine democracy if you have a winner-take-all political system. You can only have genuine democracy, participatory democracy, if the minorities have genuine representation on any governing bodies. The other thing that I would argue is that in order to have a participatory democracy, you have to be able to recall your representatives at any time. In other words, you can't have a representative spending 4 years misrepresenting you and have to wait 4 years before you are able to elect somebody new. You should be able to petition everywhere to get rid of somebody with a third or 40% of the electorate taking that kind of a position. Or if it's in a factory or if it's in a workplace, the people in the workplace to be able to to recall the union leader. The other thing that's really very important is in a participatory democracy is that we have to have a conception of democracy which is not only political in the traditional sense of government. We have to have workplace democratic control by the people who actually do the work. Now, in France, if you have an enterprise of over, I think it's 50 people, there is a law requiring that there be a works council that negotiates wages, working conditions, and benefits, whether you have a union or not. Now, unions, therefore, do not negotiate contracts in France. The contract is negotiated by this works council, and the unions put up candidates to be members of the work council, and that's how the unions compete with each other for power within the workplace. But if you don't have a workplace structure where there is real participation in the running of the enterprise, where there's real the ability of workers to say, we're not going to put out so many pieces of widgets, but we are going to put out less, where the workers are actually able to say, we're not going to go along with a two-tier system in this enterprise, whether it be a transit authority or any other kind of institution, then you don't have democracy. We have what we're seeing with somebody like Pataki and somebody like Bloomberg is they're saying we should run the public sector, we should run government and the public sector like we run our businesses, which is really dictatorial, authoritarian, where workers have very few rights unless they have a union. As we know, in most places, workers, even if they have a union, don't have a right to strike. And where they do have unions in the private sector, they only represent 8-9% of the labor force. New York is much better, but nationally. So we have to have workplace democracy. And we have to have political democracy that has a whole new situation. The other thing is, I am for neighborhood government. I don't think that we ought to have a centralized school system where a Joel Klein, who is the chancellor, and his staff can mandate that the and under the mayor's control that second, third, fourth, fifth, eighth grade students in each grade take tests to qualify to get promoted. I think we would have local school boards consisting of parents and community residents who will actually make those decisions. And at the high school and college level, I'm for students having the right to have representation on boards. Now, in the City University, for example, where I work, we have one student member and one faculty member who are ex officio of the Board of Trustees. We don't have a real democratic structure. The governor and the mayor appoint the Board of Trustees, and the union and the faculty and the students only have advisory, essentially advisory powers. They ought to have real power, especially in a place like the City University now, which is getting to the point where 50% of its operating budget is paid for out of tuition. The students are completely disenfranchised by that. They pay for it, but they don't have any real power. The legislature and the governor still has all the power. So I think there's a lot of things that have to be said to get a participatory democracy. It means a fundamental restructuring of the concept of democracy so that representation is not merely a figment of somebody's imagination or an old concept, but that representation be as democratically determined as possible, and that people have the real power to run the institutions that affect their lives.
Professor Stanley Aronowitz speaking last week with Bill DeFazio and Dina Colbert in New York City. You can download free MP3s of this or any of our other episodes at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. And our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.
Travelers, another brave man.